First question I'd like to ask you is, why does the SNP want to help facilitate stable government by supporting a minority Labour government within a country that it doesn't think should exist?
Well, the SNP is quite interesting. I mean, we've always been a constitutional party. I mean, that's one of the marks of our politics, and therefore always a very positive party. So when, for example, in 2007, when we achieved a plurality, a one vote more than, or one seat more than Labour Party, people said, oh, well, they won't go into government, they'll just sit in the opposition benches and catcall. But we didn't. We went into government and made the best fist of it that we could, which people, judged in the next election to be pretty good. So we always tend to be positive about what can be done. But there is an opportunity, and it's not just a question of establishing that block of SNP MPs and the benefits that will bring to Scotland. I mean, John Major, actually, at one point in the Telegraph today, said that how dreadful, there'll be benefits to Scotland. I mean, where does he think that's going to go down in the Scottish constituencies? There'll be benefits, oh dear, how dreadful. But it's not just about the benefits to Scotland, it's about the idea that there's going to be the opportunity to move the political agenda in these islands towards progressive politics. And Nicola, I think, has outlined this brilliantly in the debates. Now, remember, sometimes in politics it's quite useful to think about the extent of the amazing thing that's happened. In two debates in the YouGov polls, both YouGov polls, for two debates across the UK, one the general debate and one the challengers debate, Nicola Sturgeon was accorded to be the person that people would most like to support across the UK. In Scotland, it dominated. I think it was 65% to 12% or something. But across the UK, she was adjudged to be the person that people would like to vote for after these debates. Now, that's an extraordinary achievement. But it also, and it's about Nicola's style and presentation and how well she did and all the rest of it, but it's also about the core of the message, the point I was trying to make tonight, that the core of the message is distinctive from what the offerings from the three established parties at Westminster. All three of them are offering, austerity concentrated, austerity light, or austerity diluted. Mm-hmm. All three are offering austerity. And Nicola has outlined a case, and as I was pointing out, backed by the Financial Times, for goodness sake, of how we could move away from an austerity agenda. And that's what's capturing the imagination. Now, there'll be other individual policies. I mean, there's lots of folk in England who don't want to spend £100 billion on nuclear weapons. There are lots of people in England who think that. There's a lot more in Scotland, proportionately probably, but there's a lot of people in England. So there's a reservoir of support that Nicola's tapping into. A lot of folk are watching the television and saying, I wish we had could vote for that lady.
Can I just ask a brief follow-up?
Sure.
That being the case, that the SNP might end up making the rest of the UK more like Scotland, isn't there a risk that there might actually be a decline in support for independence in Scotland if the SNP can be seen to have a positive influence on Westminster politics?
Well, I think people will always know the difference between trying to edge things in the right direction and move away from austerity and the importance of having control of your own resources and your own destiny. I mean, I think there's a particular opportunity at the present moment because politics in England is A, finely balanced, and B, very desultory. I mean, they're like First World War generals. They're fighting a trench warfare campaign, both Tory and Labour. They're fighting for a no-score draw, basically. Either First World Generals or perhaps Italian football teams. They're fighting for a no-score draw, and no-score draw is what they'll get. So there is a particular opportunity at this election, but of course it's not always like that. I mean, this is a position that hasn't really occurred since the 1970s. So it depends on the stars coming into a certain alignment. There's two things have to happen. One, there has to be a huge SNP surge forward in Scotland, but secondly, you've got to have a balanced position elsewhere. These stars are in alignment at the present moment now. We're still 2 weeks from the election. Things could change, but right now it looks like a fantastic, exciting opportunity. But I think people are well able to distinguish that from the position. Well, as Nicola herself had put it, one of the things about independence is that people in Scotland would get the government they vote for at every election, not just when the stars are in alignment, but at every election. So that would seem to be a pretty strong argument for independence.
Do you want to ask one more question? We're going to the magazine.
That's what my colleague
is going
to ask. Alex, I mean, you know, for decades you've doggedly supported independence, but, you know, regardless of the consequences, can independence for Scotland always be right for Scotland? Is the principle what's important to you?
Well, I mean, I think there's an argument for self-determination as being the best state for any nation. And the reason for that are that one of the aspects of independence is that a country and a society and a people express their identity through their political process, but people have to be able to rectify their mistakes in politics. You know, if you make a mistake, then you take the consequences and try and do better. Equally, you've got to claim the advantages from things that you do well. So I think independence is the natural state, the right state for the nation, and therefore I argue for it on that basis. I also think it's important for the well-being of the Scottish people. Give me an example. And one of the successes that the Scottish Government have had in a very difficult circumstance is that we now have in Scotland the third highest number of women in the workplace. So there's 74%, I think it is, of women between the ages, working age women, are working in Scotland at the present moment, which is third to, I think, Iceland and Denmark. And we've shot up the international league table. And we're now 4 or 5% ahead of the rest of the UK, and I'm certainly ahead of England in this. Now, some of that is due to the expansion of nursery education. Some of it's due to a range of other policies, incidentally. But now, Nicola wants to expand that nursery education policy much further and move not just to 600 hours, but to effectively school hours for nursery-aged children. A big expansion of a policy, a transformational policy. Now, the connection with your question is this. The success thus far and all of these women getting back into the workplace, not just women, Estella, but it's a policy which mainly affects women's ability to be in the workplace. The benefits from that, their income tax, their VAT, their expenditure, their national insurance, their employer's national insurance, all of that has fallen to George Osborne. You know, all of that has gone to George Osborne. If these policies, the nursery education policy hadn't been pursued and the expansion of employment hadn't been as high and the revenues had been lower, he's had the benefit of that expansion. And I have to tell you, the very last thing that George Osborne has thought of doing over these last few years, as he's had probably hundreds of millions of pounds flowing into the Exchequer from that policy, is to say, my goodness me, I shall send it back to Scotland in order to invest further in nursery education. It's an example of, if you have a successful policy, you should take the benefits from that successful policy, because the success of that policy is necessary to finance the next leap forward that Nicola is planning. So I think whether it's a policy that fails that you have to rectify, or whether it's a policy that's successful that you choose, you should either get the benefits, or, and I think that's one of the, it's a kind of like a, I suppose it's an argument about moral hazard.
Can I say a quick
independence
answer?
So, say
in a hypothetical situation, Scotland were financially worse off under independence, would you still think it's the right thing for Scotland?
Well, I think Scotland will be better off as an independent country. So, you know,
even if it's poorer.
Let me answer you in two ways. There is no observable evidence that Scotland will be poorer. If Scotland becomes independent, there'll be no country on this earth who has ever gone to independence in a more favourable circumstance. And people who argue, you know, this is an argument which is dying a death in Scotland. People say, oh my goodness, you know, this country, that country can be independent, but not Scotland. People who believe, incidentally, that the United Kingdom, as it currently exists, exists in a framework where the southeast of England subsidises through its benevolence the northwest of England, the northeast of England, the southwest of England, and everywhere else, misunderstand totally the reality of the economics behind these islands. One of the most attractive things in the SNP manifesto, I thought, was to start the fast rail from Edinburgh and Glasgow to Newcastle. You know, in the sense that it's a great example of how currently the economics of the UK favour one part of the UK, the fast rail. I mean, never mind the fact that this is the slowest fast rail in history. You know, it's going to take 60 years to get to Northern England. But, and never mind all the opposition to this to it. But it's a great illustration of how that expenditure on that fast rail is paid for by everyone. But clearly, not even, I think, its great proponents would argue that a line between London and Birmingham is going to be of enormous use, initially at least, to Newcastle or Carlisle. So it's a grand example of how, you know, the economics of the UK are set in one direction. I think Scotland will be better off, but I think in particular we'll be better off because we'll be able to charge our politics in a positive direction. For politics to become positive, you know, if we get the energy, the excitement, the sort of thing we've seen in Scotland since the referendum, then you have to be able to direct policy. Otherwise, politics becomes negative. When I grew up and did my, when I got expelled from the House of Commons, well, this was mentioned helpfully by the principal today. when I got expelled from the House of Commons for the poll tax, I was right to make the point. I'm absolutely certain of that. But if you think about the nature of the politics of it, you know, Scotland was being done down because of the poll tax, because of this thing, the next thing, and the politics, the energy in politics was to stop the poll tax. And that was a great campaign, but it was a negative campaign to try and stop something happening to Scotland, as opposed to the sort of politics which is opened up by self-determination, which is people's energy, say, how do we make things better? You know, what can we do constructively to make the country better? What do we have to do to create the society that most people want to have? And the people who've become engaged in politics, in my estimation, since the referendum or through the referendum, are actually people who, you know, yes, of course, we don't want a bedroom tax, we don't want this, that and the next thing, we don't want 100 billion in nuclear weapons or whatever, but it's actually people who say, well, look, this is a political process that can actually be effective and changed. You know, here's my idea, here's my contribution, how does this fit in? And that can only happen if you've got the power to do so. Some dramatic stats. I mean, one of the most big stats in this election I've seen is 32%, I think I'm right in this, of 16 to 25-year-olds in England are certain to vote, and 67% of the same age group in Scotland. Now, just think of that as a stat. That is because people are energised by the idea they can make a difference.
We wanted to ask how you think this election differs from the last in terms of the role of social media, especially considering the Twitter response to the TV debates, candidates making perhaps unwise comments on websites like Twitter or Facebook. What do you think the impact of that will be?
Well, my view is that social media is overwhelmingly positive. I don't have much time for these people who, you know, tut about social media. Look what somebody said about such and such. Of course, some candidates, some people say unwise things, cruel things, and I think, you know, people on social media should be responsible just like everybody else is, and indeed it can be illegal to do that. But, you know, that is a flip side of something which has an enormous positive side. And so, you know, people who sort of dwell on the negative, as of course the Deadwood Press do. I mean, it's in their interest to dwell on the negative of social media, of course it is. Because, you know, ultimately, for most of them, it's a huge challenge. So clearly they're going to dwell on the negative. But the overwhelming aspect of it is positive. And my view is if we had fought the referendum campaign 10 years ago, we'd have got pretty soundly beaten because we controlled no of the great established organs of the information. Whereas it was doesn't necessarily mean it's an even contest. But it's a much, much more even contest, a much, much more level playing field, because social media is fundamentally democratic. It has its disadvantages, it has its imperfections, it has its, you know, silliness, or worse, of course it has. But it's fundamentally democratic. And things on social media tend, you know, in terms of the impact, they tend to get judged on good quality. I mean, the things that are, you know, trend are good things. You know, Ike Salmon, for example, is, you know, my parody site has more followers than Jim Murphy's real site. That is true. But, you know, that's because there's more quality in my parody site.
Can we just have one more question? So, Nicola Sturgeon was deemed the most dangerous lady in Britain a couple weeks ago, and then this morning there was John News on Attack saying that the SNP with Labour would be mayhem. What kind of effect do you think this kind of heavily loaded language has so close to the election, like on the British public?
I think, you know, I mean, obviously, I think 3 weeks ago, wasn't I being demonised us having, you know, Ed Miliband in my top. I'm just checking. So I've got a bank card and me, my top pocket. You know, I just think it's still. I think it's a foolish campaign for the Tories to fight for a whole range of reasons. But one really foolish thing is you should never put your opponents on your literature. I found that out many, many years ago. Michael Forsyth, who came into the news again today, was a very, very, very unpopular Conservative minister in Scotland in the 1990s. Now Lord Forsyth or Brigadoon or something like that, whatever he's called. Anyway, he made a quote. He said that if Scotland became independent, he'd leave the country. And because he was so unpopular, I thought, oh, that's great. You know, we'll have a poster saying Michael Forsyth. You know, Michael Forsyth. I thought, that's really witty. And what we found, we printed 100,000 of these things, and we couldn't give them away. Because people looked at it and thought it was a Michael Forsyth leaflet. You know? The stupidest thing I've just about, I thought, well, I've done other stupid things. But it was one of the stupidest things I've ever done in politics. And I learned an essential lesson, never put your opponent on your literature. One of the other times opponents been on literature, the Tories demonised campaign against Blair. You know, you won't remember that anybody who studies politics. The Tories thought it'd be a fantastic idea in 1987. This is before, incidentally, 1997, I beg your pardon. This is before it was found out that there was an element of truth in it, after Iraq and all the rest of it. But they thought they would portray Tony Blair as demonised. Blair won a landslide majority. And I think they got an award as the most cleverest poster of the campaign. Yeah, they got an award for the cleverest poster of the campaign and got thumped in the election. You know, so never put your opponents on your posters. That would be my first advice. My second advice is this. Demonising Nicola Sturgeon. The problem with trying to demonise Nicola is she's just done these two debates. Everybody's had an opportunity to see her. You know, she's been in everybody's living room and through the social media and that. You can't demonise somebody like that. You know, it's impossible. So it's really foolish. And, you know, sort of disinterring John Major, you know, who's Prime Minister. I mean, guys, what age were you when John Major was Prime Minister? John Major went out of office in 1997, right? So help me out, guys. What age?
Four, six,
right? Okay, yeah, I mean, he's going to speak with real authority to you in this campaign. But if you did remember John Major, and people like me who do, you remember the fact that he was the Prime Minister who lost every single Conservative seat in the whole of Scotland. So, you know, it does seem to me to follow, if the Tory party's salvation is to disinter John Major, you know, if you have to look, if you have to ride, if the cavalry riding over the hill to the rescue is the guy who lost every seat, you know, you're in a pretty pass, I would have thought. So I don't think demonising Nicola Sturgeon is effective. I don't think putting your opponents on your literature is effective. I think Tory and Labour as well are fighting desultory campaigns, and they'll get a desultory result.
Okay. Can we move on to this? Is this for Gast?
Yeah. This has been a very domestic campaign, even with issues, major international issues such as Russia in Ukraine and ISIS and so on. Do you think that this is a major trend in Britain to kind of do politics only as domestic politics and not in campaigns, think of EU, think globally, think internationally?
Yeah, and I think there's aspect of that extremely disappointing. The for example, the refugee crisis in the Mediterranean is a huge issue for people. It's also a huge issue which actually reflects, as the question asked me today, on the European issue. I mean, you know, I did a speech a year or so back in Bruges. And I was trying to reflect a long time ago. Margaret Thatcher made a speech, an anti-European speech in Brugge, and I was trying to make a pro-European speech in Brugge, because, you know, when in Brugge, make a pro-European speech, is my opinion. So I made it, and that speech was about how Europe should be reclaiming the social agenda. If people were pro-European, as I am, and they wanted to see a pro-European aspect to politics, then Europe would have to give people an agenda that they could see to support. And I was saying, look, this social Europe agenda, which was hugely successful in the 1990s, incidentally, in changing people's impression of Europe, this is it. This is where it lies. People are sick and tired of inequality, austerity, the extent of things, and Europe could seize that agenda in terms of protecting, in terms of the living wage. I was pointing out the stipulation which stops national governments enforcing a living, not just a minimum wage, but a living wage in terms of public contractors, is a European competition law. And here's a classic example, you know, where Europe should be turning that round on its head and saying, well, now, equally, you could apply it to the refugee crisis in the Mediterranean. It's a classic example where you'd want Europe to be leading the way, to be making the initiative. Now, of course, the Commission will say, well, it wasn't us, it was the national governments, it was the UK who wouldn't do this, they wouldn't pay that, and the rest of them. But it's a classic example where people who are interested in collective action at European level would want to see Europe seize the agenda and point in a way, and not to be in the position, as it has been this week, of under condemnation from the United Nations. So it's a, you know, because incidentally, apart from immigration, right, Europe has hardly been mentioned in this campaign. Now, they all said that Europe would be a dominating issue of the campaign, which is the UKIP. But UKIP's message has segued from Europe to immigration, because they think that's the issue they'll get purchase on, where they can get purchase on the European issue as a whole. And that would have been, still is perhaps, an issue where, you know, pro-Europeans, as the questioner asked, should be articulating a different vision and saying, well, this is exactly what we want, not just what Europe hasn't been doing, but what Europe should be doing, and the social policy being our one. So I think it's a matter of great regret, it's the nature of politics. But I do think that people have more vision, more empathy, more understanding, more compassion than certainly the Westminster politicians allow for. There's a whole army of people waiting to be led on these issues and waiting to contribute on these issues.
Okay. Do we have time for one more?
Yep,
question?
One more.
Okay. The Guardian called this an opportunity for a time of Thatcher for progressives. Do you agree?
Opportunity for that?
A time, well, the same kind of wave of progressivism as Thatcher was for the neoliberalism.
Oh, I see. So now it's the same opportunities opening up for progressive politics as Thatcher seized for neoliberal politics. Yeah, I think there is I think in politics there tends to be cycles of impression and people's wishes. Obviously in Scotland some of that optimism conveyed in the referendum campaign, there's a real thirst, but I think broader afield as well, I think there is a huge market out there for progressive politics, properly articulated, you know, properly understood, properly reflected. I think Labour missed an enormous opportunity in this campaign. I mean, the most astonishing opportunity, to allow themselves to get boxed in. In 1997, when Labour won the election by a landslide, they fought what was called a triangulated campaign, but they didn't have to do anything to beat Major. They just had to stand there. You stay upright, you beat Major, right? But this isn't that time. This is a time where you had to move. So they fought this triangulated election because they're scared stiff, the Daily Mail, the Daily Telegraph, the Tory press. You know, it's the same as the reaction to the first time that Cameron said to Miliband, you're relying on, you know, the SNP or Alex Salmond or Nicola Sturgeon, you know, isn't that dreadful? Miliband's response on that very first occasion at Prime Minister's question should have been, you've just conceded the election. You've just said, I'm going to be Prime Minister. Now, we can argue about how I'm going to be Prime Minister. We can debate that if you want, but let's just get established the fact that you think I'm going to be Prime Minister. You've just conceded the election. And as soon as you do that, you take the whole situation differently. Now, similarly, the fundamental underlying mistake of Labour's campaign is to get themselves boxed into an austerity agenda. You can't excite a campaign on the basis of, listen, see our austerity, it's slightly nicer than their austerity. It just doesn't work. And for the Liberals to say, well, listen, they've got big austerity, they've got weak austerity, we've got kind of medium-sized austerity somewhere safely in between, that's not going to work either. This was an election, as Nicola has done, where a position had to be carved out for responsible, certainly, for coherent, definitely, for sustainable, absolutely, move away from an austerity agenda. Now, when we reach a situation, which you can argue we have, where the Financial Times editorial is to the left of the Conservative, Liberal and Labour parties, then we've reached a pretty pass in politics, and it opens up the full extent of the economic, political, social opportunity that lay, if you like, for progressive politics.